The coming of the Golden Age. One could argue that things in society have always been this challenging, and the authors are just pining away for a spiritual ideal that was never reached. Nonetheless, the Hindu myths begin with the Golden Age, which is literally paradise on earth, and then gradually work their way down to the Kali Yuga over many thousands of years. All Santayana's myths, worldwide, indicate that things get worse and worse, and then we get major earth changes, which we are now seeing. Some of the myths end in a flood. The Hindu myths end in a fire. The rules of logic suggest that if all things were destroyed in a moment, at the end of every 25,000-year cycle, then no life on earth could ever have survived for very long. So obviously we can't take this prophecy literally. Similarly, the Bible begins with Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis, allegedly the first people to live on earth, and ends with a major catastrophe in the book of Revelation. That's not the end in the Bible either. The tribulation leads directly to a new heaven and new earth, a resplendent, glorious, golden age. Just as we see in the Bible, the Hindu prophecy doesn't end with destruction. The awesome Samvartaka fire leads to a new creation, the Krita, or Golden Age. And when those terrible times will be over, the creation will begin anew. The Krita, Golden Age, will begin again. And the clouds will commence to shower seasonably, and the stars and stellar conjunctions will become auspicious. And the planets, duly revolving in their orbits, will become exceedingly propitious. And all around, there will be prosperity and abundance and health and peace. In the Hindu prophecy, the Golden Age starts to restore the balance of nature and the cosmos, creating greater prosperity, abundance, health, and peace before all the hard work is finally over. Then, Hinduism's own version of a messiah, namely Kalki, comes on the scene, ready to finish the job. Kalki clearly has ascended abilities, similar to what we can all do in our lucid dreams. He can manifest vehicles, weapons, and warriors just by thinking of them. And commissioned by time, a Brahmana of the name of Kalki will take his birth, and he will glorify Vishnu and possess great energy, great intelligence, and great prowess. Vehicles and weapons and warriors and arms and coats of mail will be at his disposal as soon as he will think of them. According to Edgar Cayce's readings about this major change, the second coming of Christ is what happens to all of us as we go through this process. To him, to her that is faithful, there shall be given a crown of light. Ye become as rivers of light, as fountains of knowledge, as mountains of strength, as the pastures for the hungry, as the rest for the weary, as the strength for the weak. Therefore, the wars and violent acts you are about to read, where corrupt people are murdered, are most likely part of the dream symbolism. Rather than literally involving people being killed, it may be a symbolic story of the journey we all make within ourselves to purify the ego, that part of us that has been addicted to manipulation, power, and control. And he will be the King of Kings, and ever victorious with the strength of virtue. And he will restore order and peace in this world, crowded with creatures and contradictory in its course. That Brahmana will exterminate all the Malekas, wherever those low and despicable persons may take refuge. When the Brahmanas will have exterminated the thieves and robbers, there will be prosperity everywhere on earth. When sin will thus have been rooted out, and virtue will flourish on arrival of the Krita age. Men will once more betake themselves to the practice of religious rites. And the Brahmanas will become good and honest, and the regenerate ones, devoted to ascetic austerities, will become munis, silent meditators. And the asylums of ascetics, which had before been filled with wretches, will once more be homes of men devoted to truth, and men in general will begin to honor and practice truth. And all seeds sown on earth will grow. And, O monarch, every kind of crop will grow in every season. And men will devotedly practice charity and vows and observances. And the rulers of the earth will govern their kingdoms virtuously. If you read Helena Blavatsky's controversial work, The Secret Doctrine, more information about this Hindu prophecy appears, complete with excerpts from the original text. We find out that there are 8 superhuman faculties Kalki develops associated with this prophecy, obviously far beyond what most of us have now. As the Satya Yuga is always the first in the series of the 4 ages or yugas, so the Kali ever comes the last. The Kali Yuga reigns now supreme in India, and it seems to coincide with that of the Western Age. Anyhow, it is curious to see how prophetic in almost all things was the writer of Vishnu Purana when foretelling to Maitreya some of the dark influences and sins of this Kali Yuga. For after saying that the barbarians will be masters of the banks of the Indus River, he adds, "Thus in the Kali Age will decay constantly proceed, until the human race approaches its annihilation, pralaya. When the close of the Kali Age shall be nigh, a portion of that divine being which exists of its own spiritual nature shall descend on earth, Kalki Avatar, endowed with the 8 superhuman faculties. He will reestablish righteousness on earth, and the minds of those who live at the end of Kali Yuga shall be awakened and become as pellucid, clear as crystal. The men who are thus changed shall be the seeds of human beings and shall give birth to a race who shall follow the laws of the Krita Age, the Age of Purity." Edgar Cayce went into detail about what he called the 5th root race in his own readings. John Van Auken discussed this prophecy in the March-April 2009 issue of the Association for Research and Enlightenment's Venture Inward magazine. Casey's readings predicted the shift to a new era and a new body type that he called the 5th root race, indicating that there had been 4 previous ages and body types. The body change has been occurring in an evolving manner for some time, but perhaps through mutation, there will be new bodies, ones that will be more accommodating to soulful consciousness. We may be content with our present bodies, but imagine incarnating again in a souped-up model that allows for more cosmic consciousness while incarnate. Sounds good, especially if it coincides with a new age when Satan is bound and no evil distracts or temptations test the souls in the new earth. When will the golden age arrive? When we go back to our excerpt from the Mahabharata in The Secret Doctrine, we come across a tantalizing clue. The ancient Hindu scriptures gave us a precise time window for when the golden age would arrive. They associated this with a rare conjunction of planets in the solar system, thus allowing us to calculate an exact date. As it is said, when the sun and moon and the lunar asterism Titia and the planet Jupiter are in one mansion, the Krita or Satya age shall return. No calculation is presented in Blavatsky's book for when this may occur. But Jeff Stray presents an informed opinion in his book Beyond 2012. In The Way to Shambhala, Edwin Birnbaum says that the golden age will come when the sun, moon, and Jupiter all meet in the same quadrant as the Titia constellation, which is part of Cancer. The next time this happens will be on July 26th, 2014, according to my astronomical software, CyberSky. That's barely over a year and a half after December 21st, 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar. Until Graham Hancock peer-reviewed an early draft of this book, I was under the impression that most astronomers believed the shift from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius in the Western system also occurred around the year 2011 or 2012. According to Peter Lemessurier in Great Pyramid Decoded, the French Institut Géographique National fixed the age of Aquarius as arriving in 2011. Obviously, if there is a serious debate about the start time of the age of Aquarius, we need to roll up our sleeves and dig for the answer. Most astronomers feel the age of Aquarius begins whenever the sunrise moves into the constellation of Aquarius during the spring equinox, but no one can agree on when that is. When you go to NASA's Get a Straight Answer website and ask David P. Stern when the age of Aquarius begins, his straight answer is, I don't know. The ancients defined constellations by their brightest stars and drew no exact borders. Modern star charts have exact boundaries, usually straight lines like the boundaries of states in the western U.S., but I don't know when the spring equinox crossed the modern Pisces-Aquarius boundary. In modern times, the precession was rediscovered by Hipparchus, who began his work somewhere around the spring equinox of March 24, 146 BC. That is an important date, as we will soon see. Shirley Burchill, an astronomy historian, suggested Hipparchus was working from much older records. Much of Hipparchus's work was only possible because he was able to consult the work of astronomers who had gone before. The ancient Babylonians had left records of their astronomical observations, methods, and equipment. There is much evidence to show that Hipparchus used this information and that it allowed him to make comparisons. Hipparchus's precise measurement of the equinoxes was, in fact, a mathematical interpretation of ancient Babylonian knowledge. David Andrew de Zamora created a method to calculate when the shift into the age of Aquarius would occur, partly by going back to the original data. He sought after and was ultimately awarded a U.S. patent, number 676618, so his findings would not be stolen. In his patent, de Zamora implies that Hipparchus was inspired to begin all his groundbreaking astronomy studies in 146 BC because he was tipped off. As we just read, Hipparchus had access to ancient Babylonian records. We already have seen the Babylonians displaying the pineal gland, pine cone, axis mundi, winged angel symbols in their sacred artwork. These records may very well have revealed that 146 BC, or thereabouts, was the year we shifted into the age of Pisces. If various traditions kept this knowledge secret all along, there would have been a great deal of interest in the coming of a new age of the zodiac. No one could be sure what might happen as this pivotal moment arrived. Everyone would be looking at the stars to try to understand the greater cycle that was driving these ages. And Hipparchus's method for classifying the brightness of the stars in the night sky is still used today. De Zamora calculated the average value for the precession between 150 BC and AD 2000, based on estimates of how fast the Earth's wobble has been moving during this time, and came up with a number just slightly smaller than the traditional 2,160-year age of the zodiac, some 2,158.1914 years. If we then add that to Hipparchus's start date of 146 BC, we end up at 70 days after the beginning of the year 2012. This date of AD 2012 is accepted as significant to spiritualists, mystics, and believers, many of whom prognosticate that the Messiah appears in this year. The Hindus, the Mayas, and the Egyptian, Greek, Roman astrology tradition all appear to converge on the same two-year period, from 2012 to 2014, as the window in which major changes are predicted to take place. Hardly anyone is aware that these 2012 prophecies are truly a worldwide phenomenon, appearing on either side of the Atlantic. An ever-increasing body of data in myths and prophecies suggests that we may undergo a phoenix-like transformation into a fifth root race during this window of time, which may ultimately affect every person on Earth. It seems like an impossible, starry-eyed dream that something like this could really happen to us. But the last thing I want to do is just wait and see. I think it's even worse to just trust the prophecies and not see if we can do any further research to clear things up. Asclepius's Lament. Another excellent prophetic view of our future comes from an ancient Egyptian document that cannot be any more recent than AD 400, but is probably much older. It's known as Asclepius's Lament, and is a conversation that allegedly took place between Asclepius and Hermes, thus classifying it as a Hermetic text. The very early Christians definitely knew about it and quoted from it. G.R.S. Meade discussed the problems with dating the Hermetic texts in 1906. It is impossible to base upon it any certain conclusions as to the date of the original or its precise worth in the history of religion. That, however, our Latin translation is an ancient one is proved by Augustine's verbal quotations from it. It was thus in existence about 400 AD at least. Tradition, however, has assigned to it a far higher antiquity. The Casey readings repeatedly date the time of Hermes as being roughly 12,000 years ago, claiming he was the master architect of the Great Pyramid and also said he was a prior incarnation of Jesus. Meade's book has an older, harder-to-read translation of Asclepius's Lament. Graham Hancock combined the clearest and most poetic aspects from Copenhaver's and Scott's modern translations, giving us a newer, friendlier version that appears without credit in various places online, as follows. There will come a time when it will have been in vain that Egyptians have honored the Godhead with heartfelt piety and service. The gods will return from earth to heaven. O Egypt, Egypt, of thy religion nothing will remain but an empty tale. Only the stones will tell of thy piety. And in that day, men will be weary of life, and they will cease to think the universe worthy of reverent wonder and worship. And so religion, the greatest of all blessings, will be threatened with destruction. Men will think it a burden and will come to scorn it. As for the soul, and the belief that it is immortal by nature, or may hope to attain to immortality, as I have taught you, all this they will mock, and even persuade themselves that it is false. The gods will depart from mankind, a grievous thing, and only evil angels will remain who will mingle with men and drive the poor wretches into all manner of reckless crime, into wars and robberies and frauds and all things hostile to the nature of the soul. Then will the earth tremble, and the sea bear no ships. Heaven will not support the stars in their orbits. All voices of the gods will be forced into silence. The fruits of the earth will rot. The soil will turn barren, and the very air will sicken with sullen stagnation. All things will be disordered and awry. All good will disappear. But when all this has befallen, Asclepius, then God, the creator of all things, will call back to the right path those who have gone astray. He will cleanse the world of evil, washing it away with floods, burning it out with the fiercest fire, and expelling it with war and pestilence. And thus he will bring back his world to its former aspect, so that the cosmos will once more be deemed worthy of worship and wondering reverence. Such is the new birth of the cosmos. It is a making again of all things good, a holy and awe-inspiring restoration of all nature. And it is wrought inside the process of time by the eternal will of the Creator. Again, the prophecy of floods, fires, war, and pestilence has already come true, and we can and will prove that the Earth's recent behavior is unprecedented in modern times. Notice that this prophecy again does not involve every living thing being destroyed. It points to a world in which the gods are no longer on Earth, if such people ever did live here in the past. It also says the changes we're now going through pave the way for a new birth of the cosmos that will create an awe-inspiring restoration of all nature. Given all the other prophecies that associate the exact same set of circumstances with the 2012 to 2014 time window, this also seems to be a perfect fit. Another very curious clue in this passage is where Hermes says this transformation is wrought inside the process of time. That's a very curious choice of words. What might he mean by the process of time exactly? Could it have something to do with this great cycle? Time becomes much more interesting once we explore the new science concepts in part 2. I came across more and more of these mysterious Golden Age prophecies as my research went on, not just in Hancock's discussion of Hamlet's Mill, but in a variety of other sources. It was obvious to me that the ancients took this prediction very, very seriously. I realized that if these ancient prophecies were in fact talking about a real event, there had to be a physical process involved. It had to be something tangible, something measurable, and therefore something that could be studied scientifically. And clearly, the most important clue we're given in the worldwide ancient myths is, study the precession of the equinoxes. Find out what it really means and how it really works. As the years went by, I spared no expense of time or energy in that quest. One of the first major clues was apparently built into the Great Pyramid of Giza, which may forecast nothing less than a messianic event for humanity as we head into the age of Aquarius. Once I understood the symbolism, the symbol on the back of the U.S. dollar bill became much more interesting. The founding fathers of America appear to have been very well aware of these archaic prophecies and gave us a new and improved version of the same prophecies we see in Sumer, Babylon, India, Egypt, Greece, and Rome. The American eagle is the new version of the Egyptian Bennu bird. The pyramid is the betel, a symbol of the awakened pineal gland. The founding fathers may have even started the United States to help usher these prophecies in. And once you understand the seemingly impossible miracles of the Great Pyramid's construction, it becomes much easier to see how this may have been considered as the ultimate living proof that gods had once openly assisted humanity here on Earth.